Good morning, everybody. I'll call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Election Committee to order. And pursuant for today is March 25th, 2021. And pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. The Committee Legislative Aid will take the role.
Chair Nelson.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Nash.
Present.
Representative Bonner. Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins, I can see you, but I cannot hear you.
Somebody must have muted all. Yes, Elkins present.
Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Cleburne.
Present.
Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Representative Mason.
Present.
Representative New Brindley. See, she's joining. Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski present.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative New Brindley.
Present.
A quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Sprick. Next, we have the issue on is our approval of our minutes. And Representative Elkins, did you get a chance to look at the minutes from the March 18th?
I have, and we'll move their approval.
Representative Elkins moves approval of the minutes for March 18th, 2021. All in favor, all unmute and say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. Members, we're going to start out this morning with House File 158. Representative Jay Zhang is the chief author, but Representative Samantha Vang is going to be presenting it for Representative Zhang. We now have a fiscal note for this, and Representative Zhang, welcome to the committee, and I'll move House File 158 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. House File 158 is a simple bill, but it is important to our communities and to our democracy. The right to vote is granted to all citizens, but for some, exercising the right to vote is difficult, especially for communities with limited English. Thus, this bill is meant to improve language access at the polls. What this bill does is requires the Office of Secretary of State to prepare instructions for using in-person absentee voting, or also known as early voting, in languages other than English, and those instructions must be prepared at minimum Spanish, in Hmong, and in Somali languages, and may be prepared in other languages too. The instructions must be printed in print, electronic, and audiovisual forms. I also have a written testimony. One of my testifiers isn't able to come today due to a family emergency, and so I will read her written testimony and defer the rest of my time to my next testifier. My name is Sahul Abdul Hali, and I live in Savage, Minnesota. I'm a mother of five, and I'm a cultural liaison for the Somali Committee in the 191 School District. For the last 3 years, I've been involved in helping families get out the vote by providing transportation and translation services. I've heard so many members of my community express their anxiety about voting for the first time. It is an intimidating process and a huge step, especially if you have limited English language knowledge and no one there to help translate, which we ran into a lot. I spoke with a few women who said they showed up to vote, looked at their ballot, and didn't understand what they were supposed to do. One of them was not a shy or nervous person, but when it came to filling out her ballot, she told me she was shaking and sweating and wasn't able to complete it. The lack of language resources leaves people feeling like no one cares about them and disincentivizes them to vote. We had to work so hard to convince people that their voice matters, that it's their right as an American citizen, even if they don't have the expert knowledge of the language. Yet when we showed up to polling locations, the resources were not available to guide them through the process. Instead, we helped them. They were so grateful when we explained the process to them. So many people finally felt like they had a say in the decisions that impact their daily life. However, we as a community members and volunteers can't be everywhere at once. We need to have language resources available to help our voters feel confident and proud of casting their ballot. Voting should be comfortable and welcoming experience for everyone. I support this bill in its effort to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vang. The first person I have on the list here is Secretary of State Steve Simon. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Member Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. I want to thank Representative Jiang for putting forward the bill, Representative Vang for stepping in to testify this morning. As I said on a similar measure earlier this session, this is a really good idea. We already in our office have increased the number of languages for which we supply voter information from 5 a few years ago to now 12, if you include American Sign Language, 11 written languages, and then ASL would be 12. This would expand the scope as to 3 languages, and I'm all for it. And as I said earlier, and I don't want to just repeat for the sake of it, but I want to create a clean record for the purpose of this bill on this day and at this hearing. You know, I sometimes get asked, and maybe some of you do, and it's a totally legitimate question. I never point a finger or ascribe bad motives to anyone who asks the question, because it's a natural one. Someone might ask, and many do ask me, hey, explain to me why we would need any voting-related materials in any language other than English. After all, you can only vote if you're a citizen, and in almost all circumstances, you can only become a citizen if you pass some sort of English proficiency test or standard. So by definition, shouldn't everyone who's legally voting be converted in English? Totally fair, totally honest, and common sense question. Apart from the fact that there are exceptions to the English requirement for refugee communities, leaving that just on the shelf, there are 2 main reasons why this is a good idea. One is born of my own experience, frankly. I grew up in as the son of an immigrant and in a bilingual household. And so I know how it works in the real world. You heard some of the written testimony that Representative Vang read. It doesn't matter how fluently someone can speak English, conversational English. My own experience and that of many other people across Minnesota and this country is when it comes to technical instructions, I know how it was with my mom. This is the real world. Whether it was how to operate the toaster or a government form, when it came to technical stuff, she wanted things in her own native language as any of us would. Even if we were fluent in another language, we would want that. This is the way our brains are wired. So that's number one. And number two, this is just an extension of the tradition that we have had in Minnesota since 1896. If I were in the state office building, which I'm not right now, I could show you I have original yellowed copies from the Historical Society. Starting in 1896, Minnesota printed instructions and voting materials in a number of languages, certainly more than 3. Back then in 1896 and through the 20s, 30s, and 40s, the languages were Swedish, Norwegian, Finnish, Danish, French, German, etc. The only difference between then and now is the languages. That's it. Those languages are no longer on the list for all the obvious reasons. All we've done is look in the mirror as a state and determine which languages are the ones most often spoken in homes around Minnesota by eligible citizens who just want to vote. So for that reason, we support this bill. It's a great idea. Happy to stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. The next person I have is Jessica Velasco. I hope I said that properly. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Jessica Velasco. I am an organizer here in Greater Minnesota, specifically in Worthington with Unidos Minnesota. We are also here in favor and support of this bill, specifically because these last three elections, really, we had not only midterms and this last presidential, but we had a referendum election the year prior. And our folks that within this community and throughout all communities are folks that continue to go and apply for citizenship and just like the previous person stated, once they become citizens, they're so eager to go out and vote and exercise their right to vote. We've also had situations where it's been hard for our not only our newer citizens, but even some that have been citizens for years, to understand what the process is. There was this one time, just this last election, where a woman who had to go back and forth multiple times, three times or four, I want to say, because she couldn't find her exact polling location. And that was just one of the barriers, but then also to understand what it was like to fill out the ballot slot, the ballots. And so she was able to call me, but there is only one me. And how do we make this more accessible to our folks so that they understand, so they don't get turned away? Because sometimes it's hard for the judges to support these citizens. And I understand that at times it could be a little bit frustrating on both sides. So how do we just make this more accessible to our new citizens, to all citizens, so they can understand what they have to do, what they can do, how they fill out the slot, where can they go, how do they circle certain things in so that their vote is counted. We live in a democracy, and every vote counts, and every vote should be counted, and every vote is important. So I am here in support, speaking up for all my community, especially my Hispanic, Latino, Latina community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Velasco. I have a couple questions here. I don't see any other testifiers. Representative New Brindley, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is actually for Secretary Simon, if he would. He indicated that they currently serve as 12 languages, and he just said that this will expand the scope. I'm wondering if you can just tell us a little bit about what you do now with those 12 languages and how this would expand the scope.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley. Great question. So right now we do what I would call, you know, pretty basic information in all the languages. This last election, we had videos. We had to contract out for those to do translation that were more 2020 specific. Some of them were just couldn't be evergreen, as you can imagine, because of the pandemic. So if you go to our website, for example, right now, if you go to mnvotes.org, you'll see in the upper tab, it talks about other languages and it talks about basic information. But there's more we could, and I would argue, should be doing. This bill, as Representative gets into more details when it comes to absentee voting, for example, like actual instructions and so forth. So this would expand the scope as to three languages, the three most commonly spoken non-English languages. And that's kind of it at a basic level.
Thank you,
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next person I had on my list was Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think my question was similar to Representative New Brindley's for the Secretary, but I guess when do you decide to potentially add new languages? What's the threshold? Is it a request from somebody? I'm just trying to figure out the mechanics of that because, you know, we never know who all are going to move to our state to become citizens, and just kind of wanted to ask that mechanical question, and then I'll have a question for the chair as well.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash, very fair question. We ask ourselves that all the time. Where do you, in other words, I mean, frankly, where do you stop, right? How many people have to speak a language in the state for it to trigger our willingness to accommodate that? I'm sure there are maybe literally hundreds of languages spoken in the state. Why 12? Why these 12? And we decided early on, and it was my understanding that my predecessor did this as well. I wasn't there, obviously, to just go by the census data. You know, we're not playing favorites. We're not, that's it. Just look at the numbers, look at the latest census data. There's other data, interestingly, educational school district data about languages spoken in homes across Minnesota as well. So we fused those two together and just gone by, okay, first, second, third, fourth, fifth. We're not taking, nobody's butting in line. But to your question, embedded in your question is, okay, but where do you stop? Why 12? Why not 32? Why not 100? Frankly, some of it's just resources. I suppose if we had unlimited resources, it would be some number bigger than 12. but 12, I don't have the numbers exactly in front of me, captures a pretty good critical mass. I can't say there's a massive drop down between 12 and 13, for example. I can't even recall what 13 is. Ultimately, it came down to a judgment call, but absolutely based on the data. It wasn't, oh, this community sent more emails or this community was more aggressive, so they're on the list and not another one that had a larger number of speakers. We decided early on we're not going to do that. We're just going by the numbers. So it really comes down to resources as to why there aren't 13 or more.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to the cost, I believe I don't have the fiscal note in front of me, but I understand the cost to do these languages is $48,000. What is the cost per language to add, Mr. Secretary, or perhaps somebody else?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. Yeah, and I'm, forgive me, I do not have the actual fiscal note in front of me. But as one advantage of doing this particular fiscal note, as I recall, was we had very fresh experience in 2020 with translation services. This wasn't just conjecture. We had just done this in the summer and fall of 2020, gone with a reputable service in the Twin Cities to do translation. So I scanned the fiscal note last night. Forgive me, I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's scalable. In other words, as I recall, it sets out line by line, okay, this is how much translation services genuinely are. So I think you could reason out from looking at the fiscal note what it would cost to add additional languages.
And Representative Nash, I have it pulled up here on my other screen. It says 4 hours of staff time at $50 per hour is $200. 11 languages at $200 is $2,200. It looks like a $200 per language would translate, according to this fiscal note, would translate out, if that sounds familiar, reasonable to Secretary Simon, if that's what it says on the fiscal note.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question for the Secretary. Mr. Secretary, because I know elections administration is something that should be completely bipartisan and instructions on how to vote and all that should be similarly, how do we ensure that for now and time in memoriam that the instructions that are written down are seen by both major political parties or the major political parties so that they have a comfort level with what's contained on the instructions?
Secretary Simon.
Yeah, that's a fair question. We go with translation services, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, can you hear me? Secretary Simon.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. Yeah, fair point, right? How do you know if you don't speak the language that it's saying reports to say? And I would go beyond just political parties, any observer. How could any citizen in Minnesota know that something says what it purports to say in language X or language Y? That's a tough one. I mean, it's out there. It's on the website, so anyone can check the work. I'm happy to chat with you or others about formalizing that process. We wonder the same thing internally, not from a political standpoint, but okay, you contract with a translation service. How do we know it really says what it purports to say? I have no way of checking that work if I don't speak the language. So that's a tough one, but absolutely open to it. I mean, this is public information, so anyone can read it, hire their own belt and suspenders translation service just to make sure nothing's being slipped in there or it's being faithful to the English translation. So I would go beyond just the political dimension. In order for any citizen of Minnesota, regardless of their political affiliation, to be satisfied that it says what it purports to say, we could talk about formalizing that, I suppose, but it's out there. I mean, it's just out in the public domain.
Thank you. Next person on my list, and before I go to that, I see Representative Bonner has joined us for presenting her bill in the Capitol Bonding Committee. Anyway, Representative Carlson, you got a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, my questions have been answered to the discussion we just had. Thank you. Thank you, Secretary.
Representative Carlson. Representative Bonner, you had a question now that your hand's up there.
Yes, thank you. Jumping straight in, thank you so much for this bill. And, I can tell you as someone who worked in the industry of working on process improvement and things like that, it's really easy to convene a small community feedback group to make sure that the materials that we've supplied
are adequately doing the job that we've asked for. This is a really easy a fix or solution. So I just wanted to throw in there that as someone who uses a great deal of feedback in my work every single day, that it's a really simple solution. And certainly we can make sure that we are getting, it also is a really good quality check to make sure that the information that we're providing is really doing the job that it is and serving the communities that we wish to serve.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. And the last person is Representative Greenman, and then we're gonna lay this over. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Vang and Representative Zhang, whose bill this originally is. And I just wanted to both appreciate what I heard our testifiers say and what I heard Representative Vang say, that a key reason that this is important is making sure that communities and the voters, new citizens, and folks who don't speak English as a first language actually have confidence in the and have the accurate information. And I think that to the point of how do we ensure that folks have confidence, it's not about politicians, it's about voters. We need to make sure that voters and communities actually have confidence in the materials, and also that they have the information and the access. And so really appreciate, I think that this bill does that. I think this bill does that by making sure that folks feel welcome and have just the basic information they need about what goes where and what they need to vote. So I just wanted to make that comment and really appreciate all the work that's been done and the testifiers that came to hear this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. And with that, members, we'll lay this over. I got a text here that there's some question about it, about whether we need to refer this. If we do, we'll check that out. If we do, we may refer this later on when we get back from break. Next that we have on our agenda, and Representative Vang, if you want to hang around, your bill's up after this. But the next thing we have on the bill is just going to a short overview of the changes that the governor made with the supplemental budget. And I have here from the executive budget coordinator, Alicia Cole, and I have a Brian Hornbecker. And Ms. Cole, if you want to start first, and please identify yourself for the record and proceed. And basically we're concentrating on the stuff that refers to our committee. The additions to the budget or the amendments to the budget we had earlier that the governor had from the February forecast. Ms. Cole.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and members of the committee. My name is Alicia Cowell, and I'm an executive budget coordinator at MNB. I'm joined here by my colleague, Brian Hornbecker, who is an executive budget officer that covers the agencies within this committee's jurisdiction. So last month, State Budget Director Britta Raton and I were here with you to present the governor's biennial budget recommendations, and I'm happy to be back to present the revisions to his budget that were released last week, and I'll speak specifically to the proposals that are within the jurisdiction of this committee. So I have a few slides prepared. And just to kick it off, the revisions the Governor Walz made to his budget are in continued support of his budget priorities, as you can see here. And those are ensuring that students catch up on learning, supporting working families, and supporting small businesses and driving economic recovery. So on the next slide, we're just taking a look here at the math of the governor's overall budget relative to the February forecast. For fiscal years 22 and 23. So as you can see, the February forecast shows a budgetary balance of $1.5 billion for fiscal years 22 and 23. The governor's revised budget then reduces the beginning balance for the biennium by $206 million. And you can see that in the change column. So this beginning balance is reduced because the governor is using some of those resources for budget proposals that impact fiscal year 21. And then looking at revenues, the governor's budget increases revenues over February forecast levels by $666 million. I'll just note that is lower than his January budget. And then looking at the spending line, the governor's spending in his revised budget is $1.613 billion over the forecasted base level of spending. Just taking a look now at the budget reserve relative to the February forecast, we're removing resources from the forecasted budget reserve. The governor's revised budget restores those resources. The small amount that doesn't get restored is recognizing some need to reduce the reserve because the governor isn't recommending the full $100 million of the Blue Ribbon Commission's proposal. So that's why there is that difference from the $491 from the 2019 legislative session. Looking at the stadium reserve line, the governor has maintained his recommendation to cap the stadium reserve at $100 million. So you can see that change from the February forecast level, which is a decrease of $101 million. So in total here, the governor's revised budget leaves a budgetary balance of $61 million for fiscal years 22 and 23. And if Laura, you could flip to the next slide. Here we see just a summary of the governor's recommended spending by bill area. So you see the total is that $1.613 billion that I stated previously. And just narrowing in on the state government line, he is recommending $66 million in 22-23 and $65 million in 24-25 for spending in the state government bill area. On the next slide here, I'm just going to speak briefly about the handful of changes that the governor is recommending for the state government bill area. So for the Department of Administration, the governor has added two spending proposals. The first is $400,000 per year to improve equity and grant management. So this funding will enable the department to hire two staff to create an Office of Equity and Grants aimed at reducing economic and health disparities through providing training, policy guidance, data collection, and data analysis to support diversity and equity in grant making. The second recommendation for the department is $465,000 each year to further advance equity in procurement. So this funding will be used to provide a 40% state match that is required to receive 60% of the federal funding to operate the Procurement Technical Assistance Center, or PTAC. And this funding will improve equity by allowing PTAC to more effectively help Minnesota businesses, including those that are veteran, minority, and woman-owned, and if they're seeking to sell their products and services with state, local, and federal government entities, this office helps provide technical support to help them do so. And then moving on to the Department of Revenue, the governor is recommending $500,000 each year to increase the amount of funding available for grants to organizations that provide tax preparation services. And this funding will also help build capacity within the Department of Revenue to provide technical support, training, and resources to existing and prospective VITA, or volunteer income tax assistance organizations. So the goal here is to support expanded access for underserved populations to free tax preparation services across Minnesota. And then finally, for the constitutional officers, the governor is recommending additional funding to make security improvements to secure the physical office spaces, to make cybersecurity network improvements, and also train staff on security protocols. So overall, just increasing security for the constitutional officers. And then for the Attorney General, lastly, the governor is recommending $878,000 for fiscal years 22 and 23 to increase capacity at the Attorney General's office to provide investigative and enforcement work associated with the wage theft laws of 2019. So this funding will allow the office to create a unit dedicated to this work. So overall, in the governor's revised budget, he's increasing spending for the state government bill area by just over $5 million in the next biennium, and then $4.2 million in the fiscal year 24-25 biennium. So that concludes my brief overview, Mr. Chair and members, but I'm happy to take any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Ms. Cowell. Is Mr. Pornbecker here to testify also, or is he just to answer questions?
He is just available for questions.
Thank you. Representative Nash, I see you have your hand up.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. I saw that the stadium reserve was reduced, but still a budget item where the governor intends to utilize cash from it. And just wondering why that is now that we quite literally are going to be swimming in money, both from the feds and such. Just trying to figure out why we would do that in a time of surplus when that could potentially hamper the stadium from being removed from the tax payers' obligations. And just wondering what the rationale for that was.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Cowell.
And thank you for the question, Representative Nash. So the governor's recommendation is really just capping the reserve amount at $100 million. And so, yes, the additional resources kind of fall to the bottom line of the general fund. You know, the governor determined that this is the amount necessary really as sort of that insurance policy for the reserve. And so it's, you know, a recommendation that is maintaining from his original budget.
Representative Nash.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, was that done in consultation with folks from the stadium? Just not quite clear whether the governor has done so or not, or talked through that with them, and wondering if he intends to do so, if he hasn't already.
Ms. Cowell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, you know, I don't know the answer to that question. I can follow up with the governor's office and see if that consultation occurred.
I would appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Nash. Any further questions of this? Well, thank you, Ms. Cowell and Mr. Hornbecker. It gives us an idea what, again, what we're looking at for our budget. We'll be putting our budget together over this next week, and when we get back from break, we will be taking that up, and we will be passing that out to Ways and Means. So thank you for the information. The next item on our agenda today is House File 2297. Welcome back, Representative Vang. And again, I'll move House File 2297 to have it before us, and the intent again is to lay this over. Representative Vang, if you want to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have the DE amendment, if you'll be okay to move that first so it gets into the shape that I would like before discussing the bill.
I'll move the DE2 amendment to put the bill in the shape that that Representative Vang wants. Members, all in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, members. Representative Vang, explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 2297 develops a racial equity impact note following a similar process to fiscal notes written by the Legislative Budget Office. Last year, during the legislative special session, the House Select Committee on Racial Justice was established to declare and address racism as a public health crisis and to ensure House legislative efforts are analyzed through an intersectional racial equity lens. The Select Committee on Racial Justice quotes on their report, "Perhaps the most profound impact is that racism is sapping the strength of the whole society by wasting human resources. When the brilliance in some of our communities is ignored and we're not investing in the full education of our kids, for example, because we think there is a genius in the barrios or in the ghettos or on the because we don't think there is a genius in the barrios or in the ghettos or on the reservations, that's sapping the strength of our whole society." They also quote University of Minnesota economist Dr. Samuel Myers, who coined the term the Minnesota paradox to illustrate the tale of two states with specific groups of Minnesotans experiencing a high quality of life, while other groups of Minnesotans are experiencing poor outcomes and persistent racial disparities. These disparities are some of the worst in the nation and are measured by racial gaps across the systems in unemployment, income, wealth, incarceration rates, arrest rates, homeownership rates, mortgage lending rates, and many more. There is a cost to racism. This racial equity note will help us as legislators see opportunity costs to our state if these disparities continue to persist. And just as importantly, opportunity gains when we work on legislation to close our disparities. Section one of the bill sets the racial equity impact notes, sets the process and responsibility of creating the note to the Legislative Budget Office. Section two of the bill establishes the Racial Equity Impact Assessment Working Group to develop recommendations for defining the content and process for generating a racial equity note. And section three is link appropriations to support the working group. And this is something that I can work with the committee and the chair to define the number. And I don't think it will cost much to support a task force. And with that, Mr. Chair, I can defer the rest of my testimony to my next testifier.
And members, we have two testifiers here. Tawana Black, if you want to identify yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony. Ms. Black.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Nelson and members of the House State Government and Finance Committee. My name is Tawana Black, and I'm the founder and CEO of the Center for Economic Inclusion. We are the nation's first organization dedicated exclusively to closing racial employment, income, and wealth gaps and creating an economy that works for everyone by equipping employers, policymakers, and public sector employers with the data-informed and market-responsive solutions that are necessary to foster that economy that does work for everyone. And we work with employers across the state, not only here in Minneapolis-St. Paul, but in Duluth, St. Cloud, and all across the state to do just that. The center is uniquely equipped to be able to work with you all to foster this bill and the implementation that will come after it. And we're honored to be able to work in partnership with this committee to build inclusive and equitable economy here in Minnesota, which is an economic imperative that has never been more critical than it is today. As was just noted, the dual pandemics of COVID-19 and racism exacerbated longstanding disparities and inequities. We also know, thanks to McKinsey data and analysis, that closing racial wealth gaps can add more than 4 to 6% to the US GDP annually by 2028. As Representative Vang noted, the cost of racism is significant and is costing every Minnesotan. And yet this bill offers policymakers and Minnesotans an opportunity to begin measuring what the opportunity is to either close disparities or further increase those disparities and to begin taking meaningful efforts to adjust bills before they are legislated. The Racial Equity Impact Notes bill is critical to unlocking this potential because it ensures that key data and analysis become part of the decision-making process so that the legislature's policies and investments to address each of the racial and economic imperatives that we've outlined not only close these gaps, but also accelerate growth for the state. First passed in Iowa in 2008, racial equity impact notes have been used in states across the country to inform and equip policymakers to address the disparate impacts of legislation. Research on these types of notes shows us that by using these types of tools, informed by community and those who have the tools and knowledge and experience of closing racial employment, income, and other types of gaps, hand-in-hand in partnership with legislators, we can begin to address the cost of racism and create economic inclusion and growth that benefits every Minnesotan. Together, we believe we can write a new page in our state's history, develop processes for creating more informed public policy and legislation that will fuel Minnesota's economic growth through the power of inclusion, equity, and belonging. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Black. The next person I have on the list is Brett Grant. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brett Grant. I am Research and Policy Director at Voices for Racial Justice. The Center for Economic Inclusion, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, Voices for Racial Justice, and the Racial Equity and Joy Coalition all recommend instituting racial equity impact notes as a means for ensuring responsive policies and investments based on consistent analysis designed in collaboration with community, informed by community, and represented in a racial equity impact assessment. The answers to the five key questions of this assessment will better equip policymakers, staff, and partners to identify the intended and unintended consequences of policies, investments, and programs and reduce unintended disparate impacts. Today, many racially and economically inequitable results are produced through processes and choices that may not even explicitly address race, may appear race neutral, or may even be offered to address racial disparities because we do not have a process in place to assess the racial equity impacts of legislation. A racial equity impact assessment provides a systematic examination of how different racial and ethnic groups will likely be affected by a proposed action or decision in policy, institutional practices, and procedures, programs, and budgetary decisions. This can serve as a vital tool for preventing institutional racism and for identifying new options to remedy longstanding inequities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. I see we have questioners. Representative Nash, you have your hand up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the author. Representative Vang, just some simple mechanical questions for you. The list of people that you would include to do these notes, I think I did the back of the napkin math, and there's 20 people that you would have composed on this group. Is that correct?
Representative Vang, I believe you're talking about the working group.
Yes, sir.
Nash. Representative Vang.
I believe you're correct, Representative Nash.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Vang, how is that going to work moving forward for bills? You know, everybody's waited and waited and waited for their fiscal notes to come, and that takes sometimes, it seems, forever. And I'm just wondering how 20 folks are going to create impact notes on legislation that's moving through. And I guess I just didn't hear that in the presentation, and I'm wondering how does that work? And is that for every bill that's going to come forward? Because I'll ask that. Is that going to be assessed on every bill that we see? Because, you know, we're looking now at, I think we're well over 4,000 bills or some number like that. And that seems like an awful lot of work for this group. And I don't see a fiscal note associated with this. I'm just wondering what that is. Multi-part question.
And Representative Nash, the fiscal note's in process, and that's why we're laying this over. Representative Vang, you can answer the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, thank you for your question. So the working group will not be the ones who will be writing the impact note. It will be the Legislative Budget Office. The purpose of the working group is to develop recommendations on defining what the content of the note would look like, what methodology or the process is like to develop that note. And then the working group in the DEA amendment will expire. It's only temporary on September of 2023, I believe, if I remember correctly. Yes, September of 2023. So once they finish their recommendations, the Legislative Budget Office is the place where the impact note will be coming from.
Representative Nash.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, you said that we're laying this over. Are we going to be doing I'll say that for wrap up. I'm curious as to how this all works I'll leave that for now. I'm just curious as to the more of the mechanics, and I'm sure if this gets included in your bill that we'll have further discussions, but anxiously awaiting that fiscal note and just how this all plays out. Just because it seems like a fairly Herculean task.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bang, good to see you at the State Government Finance Committee. And I wonder, on your makeup with the group, I looked over it yesterday. Just clarify for me, because I don't think I saw that there was any members from any of the ethnic councils that we currently utilize and have for like 40 years. But can you confirm with me that they're not included in your working group?
Representative Vang.
Mr. Chair, in the DE amendments, they are not included in there. However, we did leave it parts of vague enough so they could be included, but I want to keep that open. I think that I am hesitant to include institutions to be part of the impact note when a lot of when we are still dealing, our own institutions have our own systematic issues of racism and there's institutional bias. And so I'm hesitant to include the institutions that which the impact note will be the ones creating from. And so I'm open to discussing that further.
Representative Kosnick, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bang, I think it overlooks the facts more generally to the whole bill that the state has invested in these ethnic councils, and I speak of them often in this committee, and I know that the intentions of this bill are well-founded, and there's some validity to it, but as legislators, that's part of our job is to look at the broad range of what's proposed before us, and we also have the ethnic councils that it is their charge to advise the councils advise the legislators what the impacts are to different communities. And so I struggle with not the intention of the bill, but we're just growing more government because it's a current political topic, but it should be. I think that the bill and the intention of adding another budget office kind of thingy to advise us, you know, a lot of times we don't even look at the fiscal notes unless we hate them and then use them to kill a bill. So I just think the bill misses the mark and overlooks that we currently have systems in place that should be better utilized before we create more government groups and there's unintended consequences of having another report telling us that what we're doing is not right or you know, a select committee doesn't think it's appropriate or this or that. But there's nothing to prevent these groups in your working group to advise us, the ethnic councils, to do a better job of advising the legislature of saying, hey, have you thought of this? That's why we have public hearings. And under this current pandemic and Zoom meetings, it's very, very difficult to have the public input that we normally have. But the process is set up to have the public come to us and testify on a bill and its impact. And there's nothing stopping them generally from the public from having input in that. And I think that's the more appropriate way to do it. I struggle with supporting this bill because it's just growing more government and there's unintended consequences. And the intent is noble, but I just think it's just too much. And we have systems in place that should be working better. And if you've got different ideas to do that, that's probably more appropriate. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a follow-up to what Representative Kosnick said. It just takes it in a little different direction. So I'm really glad that we have legislators who are using the ethnic councils. I know I use them a great deal when looking at legislation that I'm proposing or legislation that I believe might impact residents of my community. Representative Ng, I'm really happy that you're bringing this bill forward. I think it's a really good piece of legislation and something. So as I was reading the bill, it looks like it requires the agencies and advocates to consider the racial equity whenever we propose legislation. But as Representative Kosnick just said, I think it should be something that's should already be occurring. But to what extent does this bill just codify that this is something that now we really should be doing and making that a requirement so that these important conversations are in fact occurring if we have agencies or representatives who are not doing that. If you could speak to that, I would appreciate it.
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cleavon, for your question. The purpose of this bill is really to center the conversation between race and equity in our legislative efforts, in our legislation. And right now, if members don't speak about it, it's going to be it'll be missed. I will just say that before the Posse Caucus before the House Select Committee or before the Posse Caucus, I'm sure the legislature has never really talked about race inequity until recently. And now it's a matter of making sure that every legislation that we look at also takes into consideration race and equity, rather than just relying on peer-to-peer work or colleagues to always bring up what are the race equity impacts of that. And so this really codifies our conversations and to ensure that we continue to have those conversations.
Thank you. Representative Claiborne, follow-up.
Thank you. Representative Ng, one of the things that I've noticed in many of the committees and commissions that we already have in place, and it's something that I think we need to think about as we're moving this type of legislation forward, is so many of the commissions require previous or past legislators. And as we think about the fact that we have historically not had legislators of color in the House and Senate, it might be something that we also want to look at to make sure that when we're saying that we have to have previous or past, what is the impact of that question on the commissions as well? And that's not it speaking to this particular bill, but something that I think we need to think about. So thank you so much again for bringing this legislation forward.
Thank you, Representative Claiborne. Next person on my list is Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. I think this is a great idea. When this was first brought to my attention, I immediately saw the benefits. For me personally, as a legislator, what this would mean for me in terms of the information for me to consider as part of evaluating any given bill. So thank you, Representative Vang, for carrying this. I'm really excited about seeing this be implemented. And again, to the testifiers, Mr. Grant, I think, said it best when he talked about having a process. I mean, as a legislature, we are process-driven. And by fitting the racial equity impact note into a similar process to our current fiscal notes, it makes total sense. Having that information made available for decision-making, for very important decision making, is crucial. And right now it's completely missing from our conversation. I need that information to make sound decisions on the part of Minnesotans. So this is not something I think that we can afford not to have. This is absolutely necessary and quite frankly, long overdue. So keep up the good work on this. You've got my full support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Next person on my list is Representative Elkins.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I could give a short example from my private sector career as why I think something like this is necessary. So when I was working at Optum, one of the programs I was working in used risk stratification tool to identify people who might benefit from information based on information in their claims record for particular added care. And Optum enabled some researchers from outside to look at the claims data that the model was being calibrated for to make sure that the program was being used in an equitable manner. And on its face, this wouldn't seem to be necessary because there is no data about race in medical claims data. So you would think that on its face that there could not possibly be any bias in the way this tool was being used. But when they dug into the underlying data and associated the claims with people and were able to include data about race in the analysis, what they discovered is that people from racial minorities were being underrepresented in among the population that was going to be eligible for these extra programs. And the reason was is that because racial minorities are underrepresented in the claims data itself, because they so often don't get the basic care they need, they weren't showing up. The model wasn't flagging them for eligibility in these really good, valuable programs. So the point is that the purpose of this is to identify things that we wouldn't think of ourselves, where there might be some kind of implicit bias that, that wouldn't even occur to us, but it's there, but we wouldn't have otherwise have a way to know about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. And the last person I have on my list is Representative Greenman, and then we're going to lay this over. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vang. This is actually an issue I heard about from constituents on the campaign trail, asking, you know, as we had this conversation about really rooting out the systemic racism and disparities in our state and in our policy, how are we as lawmakers making decisions? How are we as communities making decisions? And we have fiscal impact notes, we have environmental impact statements, and how are we actually evaluating the data? One of the things I'd love, I know that, you know, to put a real, the real context on it is we make all sorts of decisions that have huge impacts and have had in the past. So thinking about where a freeway went through Rondo, thinking about, you know, how we distribute funding and how it impacts communities. Are there specific ways to the testifiers or to you, Representative Vang, that this kind of analysis upfront could inform and maybe help us make better decisions to get on the path of repairing those disparities as opposed to reinforcing them that are built in?
Before that, Representative Carlson, I'm going to hand the gavel over to you. I'm up in another committee for a bill, and Representative Vang, you can answer that, and then hopefully I'll be back to answer Representative Nash's questions at the end.
Very good. Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenman, if that'll be okay, I will defer this question, your question, to my testifier, who probably have more a better idea on the specifics of how the note can achieve that.
Ms. Black or Mr. Grant?
Representative Greenman, I would say absolutely. There was a report, and we could share this with you all, from the University of Iowa that's been the most comprehensive, given that their impact note is the longest existing, that has actually been able to show that and support a state in being able to use this in both an immediate fashion, but also over a significant period of time. I would also say in our own work, if you all have seen the news from the last 2 days, we've just worked with Ramsey County in creating the first economic competitiveness and inclusion plan in the state that has been both about how Ramsey County can right the wrongs of the past, but also foster economic competitiveness and growth in the region and ensure that it's also thinking about how to restore wealth that's been extracted out of communities of color, our Black community in Rondo, for instance, but also our immigrant communities and others, in order to ensure that that county continues to grow. We've envisioned that by having these processes that Brett examined earlier in our state, we can ensure that we're doing things both in real time that start to address the disparities that we have, but also be able to create bills and policies and investments in various departments alongside both legislators, but also department leaders that start to create a longer path toward equity and inclusion and growth for the state. Brett might have additional context.
Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Green, I hope that some materials that I provided to the committee really provide some examples of that. There's a report called Unfit for Human Consumption that looks at health and healthcare in Minnesota prisons, and a racial equity impact assessment was kind of the framework which we use with our community based research group to look at health and healthcare in Minnesota prisons. And one of the recommendations that came out of that was the reinstatement of the ombudsperson for corrections. And that happened in collaboration with our group as a result of the deep and meaningful and thoughtful discussions that happened. And then there's also the Quilt magazine, which offers different issue areas where a racial equity impact assessment was utilized to tell a deeper story about policy and evaluating policy. So there are a number of examples. I don't have all the time here to go into them, but I'd welcome further conversation about that.
Wonderful. Representative Greenman, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking forward to that conversation. I really think that this is a critical piece of policy, both for, and I think as Ms. Black said, both for us as policymakers, for experts, and also for our communities and our constituents who are electing us. Having the conversation, we cannot change problems that we cannot see and evaluate. And I think that by not having the data, we're actually just, we in some cases are making decisions that perpetuate the status quo that is not working for Minnesotans. And so I really appreciate this as an important piece of the conversation we're having at the legislature, but much broader how we as Minnesota create and really tackle these disparities. So I appreciate the testifiers and you, Representative Vang, for bringing this bill.
I'm not seeing any additional hands. Give everybody just a second before we move to Representative Vang to provide a closing comment. Anybody else? We got a few minutes left here. Okay. Representative Vang, do you have a closing comment for us?
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that this is a good bill. It'll help us make smarter policy and funding decisions. It'll help us make the best return on investment. It will help us become better stewards of public dollars. By 2030, all baby boomers will be older than 65, while the fastest growing groups are Asians, followed by Hispanics. We are becoming older and more racially pluralistic society. And if disparities continue to persist, and we know that has been exacerbated by the pandemic. So it is crucial that we act now to build a thriving community for the future. And with that, I ask the committee for your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vang. And with that, I will lay over House File 2297 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, that's all we have for an agenda today. We do not
have.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Nelson, welcome back.
Well, I'm still waiting to start over here, but Representative Nash had a couple of questions, and hopefully we can answer a few of those questions before. I think it's about our upcoming delete all amendment for our omnibus bill. Representative Nash.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Wondering, as you build the bill over the course of our break, is it your intention to have the finance and policy bill built and do a separate elections bill, or are you going to be including elections provisions in the bill? Just trying to figure out how that's going to wend its way through the legislature.
Representative Nash, at the current time, we're planning on not my phone's ringing, somebody else, but I'm planning on putting a little bit of some of the campaign finance stuff in. The bigger election stuff would be in a separate bill going forward. But it would be mostly the policy. It would be one bill, the policy, and then some of the minor, less controversial election stuff that I think we hopefully can all agree on that's not substantive.
And Mr. Chair, are you intending to generate an elections bill yet this first year of the biennium, or is that going to be reserved for next year, or what's your plan there?
Probably at this moment, we're probably going to be looking at, if we talk about that after the break and after we get our omnibus bill out, it's more solid, probably something for next year. We do have a couple of election bills that have gone through that come here that are winding their way through the process. But I think that a bill coming out of our committee would probably be next year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. With that, members, Representative, anybody else have any questions? If not, members, we are adjourned.